This is the Snack Bar Games Podcast, episode 231. We chat with Level 99 Games' Brad Talton and Gamer Chris's Chris Norwood about the world of unplugged gaming and why you should explore it. Then, Sean, Jeff, and Chris join me to talk about the 3DS XL, East Origin, Pokemon Conquest, and more. Let's get this started. Snack Bar Games Podcast. Some special guests today. Proprietor of GamerChris.com, Chris Norwood.
Hello.
Because we need three Chris's on this podcast.
Yeah, there's a lot of Chris's here.
Yes.
You want to change to Chris, Graham?
And we have talked about this before. And that is Brad Talton, the lead designer and owner of Level 99 Games.
Nice to meet you all.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you too. Thanks for joining us.
So hey, we are here... Oh, yes. Okay. We are here to talk about board and card games. And, you know, we talk about this pretty regularly on the site, mainly with the Gaming Unplugged column.
Every other Friday.
Yes, indeed. But there are definitely some people, I know some listeners who just haven't taken the plunge yet. And they definitely should, because it's a lot of fun. So I first wanted to get you guys to kind of talk about what makes the hobby so great, like the qualities about it that make it just so wonderful.
Face to face gaming more than anything else for me.
Yeah.
Like back going to our video game roots, N64, GameCube, and to a lesser extent now the Wii. You get everybody around your living room doing the same thing. That's fine. But you also have the online component now, especially these days, where you're not so much with the people as much as you're talking to each other on headsets, much like we're doing now.
Yeah.
And but it's really a solitary experience, just loosely connected. But with the board games, even at its most basic, like chess level style games, it's one-on-one, face-to-face, you versus another human being, or sometimes with another human being, with a lot of Chris Norwood's favorite games. Just all there, and it's the camaraderie and the interaction between players and like bluffing and tells and all that good stuff. You don't get that with most of the video games that you have to deal with these days.
Yeah, there's definitely something. I mean, to me, I think it's a combination of that social aspect of being able to be with people and kind of, you know, have a shared experience like that. But then also the nature of games like that make it so... Usually the mechanics are really easy to understand to the point where you kind of know how the game is working in a way that is not
the
really...
The limitations of this physical medium and the fact that you don't have as much control over the experience as a designer means that when you create a game, the players are an essential component of the game. Like when you play, say, like Gears of War, you're stepping into their game, but when you play something like Arkham Horror around the table... You're kind of creating the game as you go. You're an integral part of what's happening in the gaming world. So,
right, and you know, Brad, you have developed both kinds of games, and so I think you know you have that different perspective on that. Is it any different on your side as far as how you approach?
Yeah. There's differences in every sphere between the design standpoint and also the production and just in like the direction that you can take when you're doing a video game versus a board game or card game. So I think like with the biggest thing is probably the guidance that the designer can give to the players. When you're playing on a video game, you can control every aspect of the game. You can control how you know new elements or new abilities or powers are released to the players. You can kind of time release things and make sure that the complexity grows steadily. You can control the like the order that events happen. You can make the game state modify permanently for future games, and all these sorts of things that you can do that aren't necessarily possible or are much more difficult to do with a physical board game medium.
Well, Chris Norwood, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about this stuff. You're generally quite the proponent of getting people involved in playing board games. I you know, you kind of lead your local board gaming group and get a lot of people playing. And so I what are your thoughts on, you know, the board game experience?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is definitely the social piece, just the being together and working together and seeing real people across the table rather than, again, through some online or just electronic kind of, you know, system. But kind of touching back on what you said a little bit earlier, Graham, actually, I think the transparency of board games is one of the cool things that I like about it. That, I mean, I enjoy all the social piece and all that, but I really get into it most of the time just to see the system of the game and to understand it and to be able to play around in it some. And, you know, a lot of video games, a lot of that stuff is hidden or it's so complex you couldn't understand it. But, you know, I can see the rules. I can read the rules. I have to read the rules, just like Brad was saying. I mean, no one's going to kind of force feed me the way to play the game. And so then you kind of get to figure that out. And then it is also then that shared experience of, you know, as you're trying a strategy or you're just learning the game or whatever it happens to be, you know, you're right there with these other real people doing that. So I think that's kind of that the game system. And again, as a potential game designer eventually one day myself, you know, kind of making that transition as well to how do I convey this experience that I want to have in this purely analog, you know, media.
Right. So I kind of want to pose this to all of you. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, at least in the, you know, board game industry, of the gateway game. And I think a lot of that talk is largely geared toward people who don't necessarily play games at all.
Mostly geared toward, I think, is getting people away from the mainstream Hasbro, Parker Brothers type stuff of Monopoly, Risk, Life, and into the more European style, Ameritrash. It's not so much, I've never played a board game before in my life, I've never played a good board game before in my life.
Right. But I think a lot of those choices are definitely ones because they're not that complex. And, that, you know, they're easy to grasp for people who aren't used to things like that. But I think people who play video games are kind of used to a lot of mechanics and a lot of interesting things. And that really, you know, it takes a different type of gateway game for people like that. And so I was wondering if you guys had any, you know, any games you would suggest for people who haven't really played that, but, you know, are really, really, you know, deep strategy gamers. They just haven't really done the Unplugged thing.
I don't know if I have any specific, because I think, again, as you get away from the ones that Chris are talking about, Chris, that's kind of funny. But as you get away from those that are really aimed against these non-gamers or you know, I guess traditional gamers, you know, as people walking into our group, let me just kind of talk about that. You know, we don't tend to sit them down and only play with them, you know, games that we think are on their level, because frankly, I think that's kind of, you know, talking down to them, or it's, you know, it's expecting very little from them. And like you said, especially people that have significant, you know, electronic gaming history, to me, it's more a matter of a game that you're interested in. I mean, if you like, you know, Cthulhu stuff, then Arkham Horror or something like that. You know, it really
Elder Signs in that case, I think probably, but yeah.
Well, that's true. That's the one I would recommend. But it really comes down to more where your interests are, and maybe theme or. I mean, there's a couple of games that have tried to replicate the real time strategy thing. So you know, something like that. Of course, well, yeah. In some ways, almost every game, you know, is a turn-based strategy game on a board game format. So, to me, whatever you think you would like, I think is probably the best gateway game for you.
That said, for the specific crossing over of like our main audience, our video game audience, into the board game room, there have been, especially lately, a number of video game themed board and card games coming out. I've seen the Resident Evil card building game. I've seen Gears of War, the board game, which is a reskin basically of Doom, the board game.
And then, you know, there's a lot of versions of Civilization. a couple of them actually Sid Meier's Civilization branded.
Which is kind of funny that that started as a board game and then became a video game, but still.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, there's some crazy things like that. I'm particularly fascinated by the kind of things that just cross over and then over again. We've definitely seen a lot of that with, like, you know, the App Store and things like that. There are really a lot of electronic implementations of board games and card games. But there were a couple that just blow my mind how they keep jumping back and forth. I think the one that comes to mind most to me is the Panzer General series, which the original computer game was based on, like, you know, hex tile war game, really hardcore things. And then they made, you know, an actual Panzer General game. And then they decided that that was too complex, so they made a simplified version of that game for Xbox Live Arcade. And then they released that as a board game. Which I just... my head explodes when I think about it. But I think there are definitely a lot of... like, with games like that, it's kind of... it was kind of already there to begin with, so having it jump back and forth, I guess, is just kind of natural. But I did want to mention a few things about, like, how games kind of try to go back and forth. And Chris Norwood, I know you've played a lot of gaming apps, and Brad, you've made some. So I really wanted the insight into, you know, how successful you think those kinds of things are. I know a lot of people think that it's just not really the same, but there's definitely some value there, right?
Well, I think part of it is it's a way as a board gamer to do some sort of board gaming activity when you're not at the table. And especially, you know, with more of the asynchronous play options that more and more of the apps have, you can even play against a real person as opposed to just to AI. So that's probably the biggest thing to me is, you know, as I'm sitting there, you know, waiting for my supper or something like that, it lets me pull out my phone and do something that's kind of part of my hobby anyway, rather than just playing an Expo Jeweled or something like that. So
play 14 games of Ascension.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. If I had an eye device, that's basically all I would do with it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's like as a developer, it's kind of a way to share the games that we create with players without incurring huge upfront costs. You know, printing a board game is, you know, $20,000-$40,000. But to make an app, you know, it only takes you know, time if you're a programmer and a bit of graphics work. So, you know, you can produce a game, and like we produced Noir, the Killer vs. Inspector game, when it wasn't feasible to make the card game, we went ahead and made the app first to show off to people kind of how it worked.
Right. So, and there is something to be said from the consumer end. It's a similar situation. It's not quite the scale that the developer has, but, you know, for example, you want to try a game, you want to, like, try it for this app and, you know, see if you like it. And then maybe take the plunge on, you know, the inevitably large price of shipping large boxes of things across the country. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got a lot of people who want to play Battlecom the board game now that they've played our app that recently came out. So it all kind of rolls back around. But, like, the big difference with apps is that people have different expectations. You expect you to have AI. They expect you to force feed them the rules, you know, bit by bit in a tutorial.
Yeah.
So if you show someone an app and you say, go read the rule book, they're going to be like, what? So that's the biggest complaint that I get on a couple apps that don't have an integrated tutorial.
Right, but I do think that is a great way to teach people the game as well, rather than having people sit down. And I've been in games where you sit there for a good 20 minutes trying to explain something, because, I mean, as good as people are at explaining games, and Chris Norwood, I know you're great at it, there's something to be said for someone doing, like, a professionally produced, like this is the most intuitive, you know, way to say this.
The big trend these days is to put in the back of your rulebook a little QR code that when you snapshot it takes you to YouTube for the rules demo.
Yeah, that's cool. So.
Well, I think these are just, there's always, like Brad, you were saying, you know, to get that experience straight across to the consumer, whereas in a video game it's hard programmed, you can kind of cross that over in an app. I think that's a lot of the success that you know, Days of Wonder certainly has had with the 70% sales jump they record for the Ticket to Ride series after, you know, the app hit everything. And I think part of that is the fact that people don't like to learn rules. People out there that aren't gamers anyway, they don't like to learn rules. And if you can have a way that force feeds them or escorts them through the process, that makes it so much simpler, and then therefore can cross back over to the board game.
Right.
So I have a quick question for you guys. So
yes.
Out of the group, I'm probably the least experienced board game player.
That's safe.
That's more than safe, right? So just for context, my experience is limited to your traditional Hasbro games that I play with the kids and playing one round of Settlers of Catan. So that is the depth, right? So I am your quintessential, never really gotten into this. So, you know, the iOS apps, kind of some of the Xbox Live arcade games, those are really interesting, right? Because when I look at board gaming as a whole, it's pretty daunting, right? The games are significantly more expensive than your $9 game at you know, that I can pick up at Target. They're a lot more complex, right? So, you know, the learning the game plus the time investment to actually make it through a round is pretty daunting. So I'm curious, are we seeing or are you guys seeing a lot more people kind of get into the board gaming hobby through iOS? So I guess, Chris, Norwood specifically, if you're kind of shepherding people into this hobby, are you seeing a lot more people that are coming as a result of playing these iOS games?
I don't think personally that's my case at all, but kind of in the big industry, well, I don't know, blah, 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 whatever. I have a feeling that more casual people who would be willing to pick up an app for 99 cents or $2 or something like that are making some of the transition to buying some of these games. But no, for the most part, I would not say that I've had any gamers. Chris, do you know of anybody that's come to our game group because they've experienced an app or anything?
Not necessarily because of an app, but I can see it being step one of like a 3 or 4 step process. Like, like I can especially see like somebody trying like Dudes of the Planeswalkers 2013 just came out this week for everything.
And we're reviewing that.
Well,
site business real quick. Yeah. Anyway.
Right. Like that would get people interested in like Paper Magic. So they'd come into the store and like they walk into Hypermind, the store where Chris Norwood and I play at, and they would see all these other things there while they're waiting for our store owner to take care of them as far as cards are concerned. They may be curious about that. And if they come in on a Tuesday night, especially if they see all of us back there doing whatever the heck we're doing. And that kind of curiosity drive-by factor is, like, I think, the major drawing to most of the new people that we have.
Now, yeah. I think I have heard quite a few people, especially that are already gamers, whether it's role-playing gamers or video gamers or something, through the Ascension app. I mean, everybody knows that pretty much. And that lots of them have bought, you know, the physical copy, and then maybe that has kind of shepherded them a little bit. Again, I don't know about locally with us, but I've heard of that quite a bit through some of the other podcasts I listen to and things like that. Even the role-playing podcasts that I listen to. That, you know, a number of them are talking about it, and on Twitter they talk about it and are asking. And I think that's it has made some crossover within the sort of geeky gaming culture already to kind of maybe bring that together a little bit.
Right. So. And so I personally have had a little more interaction with, I think, this kind of stuff. Maybe less the apps and more so, you know, Ticket to Ride and Carcassonne and Settlers got Xbox Live Arcade releases. And I've noticed a lot of that. With that popping up on like people who play video games on their radar, when that's the thing, maybe they'll try it, maybe they won't. I know at one point Microsoft gave Carcassonne to everyone over a Christmas break one time, and I know a lot of people who just started playing it then. It's, maybe they don't go from that to walking into a game store and buying a game, but I've definitely found people a lot more receptive to...
Like plants the seed.
Right, and then also like if you're, you know, over and playing games with people... you know, maybe you take a break from Mario Kart. Like, hey, how about we play Carcassonne? Oh, yeah, that. Sure. Yeah, I'll play that. And so it's definitely a long process, but I think people are more open to at least participating, and that allows, you know, people like me to be able to play more and just, you know, enjoy the hobby more because I get more people to play with.
That's always good.
Yeah. But, you know, Brad, I wanted to talk to you because... Not only have you kind of done both, but you've definitely done some products that are kind of very specifically catered toward the kind of people who like both. You have some projects you're working on now, but I know BattleCon, your game, was kind of based on this, like, very heavily, like, Japanese-inspired kind of, you know...
2D fighting type
right,
games.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so kind of, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between people who enjoy competitive games like like competitive card games, like say Magic, and also people who enjoy competitive video games, like Street Fighter or Tekken or whatever. And so,
no one likes Tekken.
Okay, fine. All right.
StarCraft, that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
It's fun if none of you know how to play it. Then it's okay.
Yes, absolutely.
If you know how to play it, it's broken. But that's but what I think that that this overlap, this kind of bridge between these two, what you see is that what people like isn't the video game and it isn't the card game. It's the head-to-head interaction with another player. This strategy type, mind game, and that's what we try to capture with the product, you know, and put it into a digital and physical version. And in a sense, it does. Like a lot of people who've come from video games, they email me and they're like, "Brad, this is, it's great. It captures everything that I liked about Street Fighter, except now I can think between my turns," which I like.
Yes.
So that but yeah, I think that a lot of these games that kind of bridge the gap between the what we like in video games and what we like in board games, because video games are so huge. They have so much research into players, the way players think, the way players act, the way that what players like about their games. And it's just now that the board gaming industry is starting to look over and say, "Hey, these guys have done all this research that we could use." And now you see really innovative games like, say, Risk Legacy popping up, where you actually modify the game on every specific run through, or you see a lot of mechanics coming over from board gaming, like achievements that there are board games now that have achievements that you like stick on your game box that unlock things within the game.
Yeah.
Does that work? That sounds very, very confusing to an outsider.
Well, I can tell you how Risk Legacy works. It's basically base Risk, except with a much quicker end game. You only have to get 4 points instead of conquering the entire globe. So it's like Chris Norton and I started playing a few of them. Our first couple of games were done like one or two turns around the table, and our first game was done. As you do certain things in the game, like the person who wins the game gets to place a city on the board or something and name the city
or even tear up a card so that it can never be used again.
Do things like that. That's small scale modification. But along the way, like as you reach certain thresholds, like all the major cities are in place. Well, now you get to place the world capital and unlock all these extra cards that are in like a pre-sealed thing. Do not open until this condition has been met.
or new rules would literally be stuck into the rule book and things like that. So.
Right, yeah. It's like you get like labels that you paste, like put this on page 12, and now it's part of the rules of the game.
Yeah, so. And what you see too is that the developers are doing that same thing that they do in video games. They're force feeding you the rules bit by bit and gradually making the game more and more complex. If you walk a new person into game 15, Risk Legacy, they're going to have no idea what's going on.
What are these stickers?
And you walk them through, it all makes sense.
One thing I wanted to try to do with you guys is, our esteemed editor-in-chief has already admitted he has not played many games. And I think, we talked earlier about the kind of gateway things, and I agree that it's one of those things you kind of have to take it on a case-by-case basis and whatever people happen to like. So I wanted to see if you guys could help me get him playing board games.
All right.
All right.
Now, is he looking for board games to play, like with his wife and his friends, or with his little kids? Because those are two completely separate things.
All right. So the more likely scenario is playing with the family. So I've got an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and me and my wife. So if you were going to target something and have it stick, it would be something to that demographic.
My go to for young children like that, would probably be something without resorting to. Some of the stuff that Chris Norwood, I know, will suggest, since he actually has two children, a little bit younger than yours, I think. But my go-to for that when I see like families come into Hypermind is Dixit. Basically, if you ever played Balderdash, where you basically try to make up definitions of words, it's kind of like that, but you have these gorgeously illustrated cards, like trippy dreamscape-type looking cards.
They're a little strange.
I got the newest one, the Dixit, what the heck? Journey, I think it is, which is basically a reissuing of the first game with new cards. And those cards are a little bit more tame than the first three sets that they released, but they're still kind of out there. But yeah, you basically, one person around takes one of the cards in their hand, describes it in the center, so less, and then everybody else contributes a card from their hand that they think kind of meets that description, and then they get mixed up, and then everybody who's not the active player, the storyteller, has to try to votes to identify, try to pick which one they think is the storyteller's card, and points are distributed like according to how well or how poorly the storyteller did at describing the card. But there's a penalty for being too good, and there's a penalty for being too obscure, too. So
right.
You kind of want to hit that sweet spot where at least one person gets it, but everybody else gets also points for people voting for theirs. Where I find that's good with little kids is it really forces them to like, use their imagination. Like you get to point out like themes on the cards, like colors and shapes and what you think is going on here. And it's really, other than that, just dirt simple.
The rules like, are so simple, it's hard to play wrong.
Yeah. Right. I just love that game because I know when it's on my turn, I come up with something to say. And, I mean, a lot of the time, I'll just come up with, like, the most straightforward thing I possibly can and then, like, find out when other people play their cards. There was totally a card that met that description way better than mine. And I made up the description. But, yeah, I that is a pretty great game.
Well, can I ask you, like, what kind of – so you play a lot of video games, of course, being a snack bar editor. So what kind of video games do you play?
We play a lot of puzzle-based games, right? So when I say that, kids love all the LEGO franchise games, absolutely hooked to those. Spend a lot of time playing some old throwbacks, so all the old Star Wars Battlefront. Play a lot of that now. Not sure that translates real well over to a board game environment.
I guess what I wonder is when you see a board game or you see a video game on the shelf and you say, I'm going to get such and such an experience from this game. Mm-hmm. What kind of experience is it that excites you? And there's probably a board game that'll match that.
Okay, so interesting question. That's really hard to describe since it's driven primarily by what I think the kids will enjoy these days. Mm-hmm. Most of the gaming we do is really geared towards that. So I'm looking for something that's going to be entertaining, but I don't think is going to be too complex or convoluted from a rules or kind of an engagement perspective, but also something that I'm not going to be bored to death with, right? Because the likelihood that I play it, if it's really, really boring, you know, is just really low. So
I guess I would recommend starting with Carcassonne because it's very visual. Mm-hmm. And it's very very easy to play. Rules are very obvious. Just line up the tiles so they match.
Yep. I'm glad you suggested that because I know Chris Norwood was not going to.
As much as I hate to admit it, that's actually a good recommendation in this particular case.
If you have kids,
is perfect.
If your kids are at like the reading age and the age where they can play more complex games, mm-hmm. you might want to jump them into Dominion because you get the same puzzle feel where you're trying to connect things together, but now you're trying to connect abstract effects to build an engine, which is like a much more sophisticated version of kind of what you do in Carcassonne.
Yeah. Okay. What about high strategy games, right? So I don't know if this is considered a mainstream game or not, but Stratego is a game my son has just recently picked up and has been playing it quite a bit. So earlier today, he actually almost beat me. So I was not letting him win. So I don't know if that's bad for me or really good for him, but either way, something that, you know, he seems to enjoy kind of that strategy based games.
Yeah, well, the column I did a couple weeks ago was on two of the Project GIF games, Yinch and Zerts.
Yeah, I was going to say,
yeah,
I was going to say that like an abstract strategy game, those are pretty great because the rules are usually really simple, but then the depth of them is kind of crazy. I think you'd have a lot of fun playing like Blockus or maybe Circus. Blockus is a relatively
Pentagon.
Recent one. Yeah,
Pentagon's another one that you can find anywhere now. It's really neat. It's basically tic tac toe where you twist things and pretty simple.
There's a really neat one called Laser Cat. I don't know if you guys have
seen Cat.
Yes, we've seen
Cat. It's fun.
I've got it on my shelf.
Yeah, so that one has a laser. So.
Basically, you move a piece and then you push your laser and the piece that gets tagged.
It's the mirrors and it controls where the laser ends up. And you're trying to build this mirror chain that will guide the laser to your opponent's target.
That sounds really, really cool.
But yeah, I Chris Norwood, if you had any suggestions, I know you have kids and know that kind of area well.
Yeah, of course, like I said, my kids are pretty small, so I haven't done a lot of gaming with them directly, but I have lots of plans, right? And one thing I think that tends to work really well, like if I'm going to a family reunion, I'll take these kind of things along a lot, are some of the simple dexterity games. One that's available pretty much everywhere is Sorry Sliders. I don't know if you've seen that. But Sorry Sliders has the name Sorry. It has little pawns, but there's a little ball bearing in them. And you actually like flick them and try to get them onto a certain place on a little central board. And really, I mean, as long as the kid can flick, they can pretty much play the game. And it's a lot of fun. There's lots of different ways to arrange the boards, too, to have different amounts and just different strategies or techniques of playing. But that's definitely one that's cheap and easy and pretty much everybody can have access to. I think along with that, Animal Upon Animal is a stacking game where you have these wooden, blocky animals. It's by a company called Haba. That is from Germany and makes all these kind of wooden kids games. And this is one that I think I probably played it 20 or 30 times before I ever actually played it with a child, because it's just that much fun, even with adults.
Yeah.
So those are that kind of thing. And there's just a ton of those basic little manual dexterity kind of games that that really appeal to kids and they can pick up quickly, but even adults tend to have a lot of fun with.
Yeah.
So definitely look around for some of those.
While we're talking about dexterity games, do you have a big table? Do you have like a big table, Chris?
not a huge one, but yeah, pretty big enough. So why? What are you looking for me to set up?
This is going to Pitch Car. Pitch Car.
Yeah, I think. See, Pitch Car is kind of it's really the one you want in some ways, but the one you can afford and that fits your table is Sorry Sliders more. But
yeah, no, absolutely. But yeah, I for those of you who don't know, which is probably most of you now that I think about it, Pitch Car is this game where you basically set up a track with like these puzzle pieces, and then you flick around your car, take turns going around the track.
Remember those electric cars that you used to have as a kid, like the luxury electric cars?
Slot car without the slot.
Yeah, it's like it's that, but it's manual.
Yeah,
it's all wooden track and all wooden like discs as the cars, and it's way more fun than it has any business being. So
no kidding.
It plays up to 10, doesn't it? So even if you have a huge party, the adults will play too.
I think 8. Was it?
I think 8's what it comes with. Yeah.
I mean, but, though, at this point, if you just have more of the little little token things that you use as cars, then you could just play with more people.
It scales.
Yeah. There is a
and there are more pieces. There are more pieces. You just get like all of the pieces.
There is a Pitch Car Mini. That's one thing too. That'll fit on regular tables. It's kind of smaller, and so it's a little harder to control them, I understand. But that's another option for less money, because it's a very expensive game too. That's the other, with all the wood and the import and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's from France, right?
Right, Fertia, I think.
Yeah, that is a thing. Shipping large boxes from Europe is already kind of a problem for board games. But shipping large boxes full of wood is tougher.
Fast.
Yeah. But I think, any of that sound appealing to you?
Yeah, it definitely does. So we've actually played Sorry Slider, so I was interested to hear that you recommended it, because it feels more mainstream than kind of some of the other ones we've talked about. I'm going to have to go back and listen to this. I'm not scribbling down game names.
That is one great thing with Hasbro lately, is that they have realized that if they put the mainstream names on things, that they'll sell pretty well, but they've been doing some interesting things. Like we were talking about Risk Legacy. They've done some interesting things.
Waterdeep. With...
Yeah,
that's not so much Hazard as Wizards of the Coast, but yeah, that's still.
Well,
I mean, they're
all the same parent, right?
Right, but it's the Wizards guys who developed that more than it is the Hasbro corporate.
Right, but they've definitely tried some things with like larger properties, which I'm happy to just get people playing different stuff. So that's pretty.
I think I've even seen some of the later versions, the newer versions of Stratego have a lot more elements in play.
They definitely do.
Numbered units.
Besides Risk Legacy, the Risk itself, there's a couple of different variations on that. It's like 2210 or whatever the heck the actual date is on that. And Godstorm. There's all kinds of... They've iterated Risk a couple of times. It's not like the Monopoly themes where they just paste the theme on and it's still the same silly game.
Right.
But this is like...
It's a different
game. They've taken some risks with that
With that some risks with that franchise.
Probably. Weird.
Thank you.
He'll be here all night, folks. Try the deal.
Let me get into another recommendation, because sure. I think I would be mad at myself if I didn't mention a cooperative game, and that's Forbidden Island.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that. It's you can definitely find it at Barnes & Noble and almost anywhere like that, but it's a cooperative game. You may have heard of Pandemic was sort of the original, and GameRight, which is a family game company, went to the designer and basically said, could you kind of make this more for families? And so you're going to this island. There are all these different tiles, and you're trying to get these four different, artifacts or whatever, treasures, before the island sinks. And so you're trying to run around and help each other by trading cards and by, you know, flipping tiles over that are about to sink. Excuse me. And basically you win or lose together. Either you get all four of the treasures and you get back to the helipad and leave all together. But if anybody dies or if you can't get one of the treasures, then the whole team loses together. And to me, with my wife, with, you know, my budding gamers with me here, that idea of playing a cooperative game has always been just a cool thing. I love that interaction anyway, but especially for families, I think that's a great way to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, Forbidden Island seems like, I mean, for one thing, it's a very gorgeous, well-made game. And
it's like $15.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's what I was going to say. And it's
mass market. It involves Noble. So.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not as weird as walking into, you know, some of the local stores that you've never been to before.
Yeah, though you should get there eventually, but baby steps.
Yeah, eventually. That's where the party's.
You know, I think that's a great suggestion, because it's just so easy to understand, but it has a lot of what makes games like Pandemic or any of the, you know, getting into the deep end of cooperative games, and I love those things. That's just kind of like it's a great way to, especially you're getting your family together and you don't necessarily want to hate each other at the end of the evening,
right?
Yes.
So it's nice
like
to be able to
every
work
game
together.
Of Monopoly ever.
Yeah.
You know, another fun one that I could recommend would be Arabian Nights by Z-Man, if you like more of a storytelling type.
There's a lot of reading in that game, though.
There's a lot of reading, but you can do fun voices. It's like story time or with a point. With a destination in mind.
Yeah.
So if your kids are of that age where they can hold attention on something like that, it's quite a fun one. I played it with my 8-year-old stepbrothers and they had a ball with it. Yeah. So.
Well, yeah. So I expect you to be able to play something and tell us how it goes. All right.
I'll do that. I'll do all that.
Right. So let's move on, and you know, we don't have to spend all the time talking about getting video gamers in and things like that, because a lot of us just love games already. And so I just wanted to go around and kind of talk about the games we've been playing lately, and just what you're excited about now. And Brad, how about you start?
Oh, well, you know, my favorite game is always whatever I'm working on at the moment.
Yes.
we've been playing a lot of Pixel Tactics and Noir.
Yeah, I've heard of those games.
Yeah, they're on Kickstarter, you know, but that's neither here nor there. You can Google for them. But we're kind of like trying to create a family game collection right now. So that's what I'm working on these days.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because it's definitely an interesting proposition, and there have been a lot of board games on Kickstarter, almost to the point where that's basically what that site is.
Yes. Well, if you're in games, then yeah, it's all about games. My my wife, she's all about furniture, and she thinks it's a furniture site. So.
We just need to combine these two markets.
Yeah.
Get on that. Yeah. Game.
That's California, by the way.
Yeah.
The board game about furniture buying.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Or you know, Chronicle or Crenocle, which is a furniture that is a board game.
Yes. Gotta get one of those someday.
Yeah. But yeah, so what you're doing instead of like kickstarting one game is that you're kickstarting, I mean, nominally five, but essentially four games and like one collection.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that like basically with the industry, there's a lot of costs associated just with, you know, getting things from here to there and kind of doing them all at once.
Yeah.
What's your thought behind that?
Well, you know, when you make a game, regardless of how good it is, you still have to sell it. And when you if a game only fits into a little you know, like $5 box or $10 box, the publishers don't want it, and the game stores don't want it because it doesn't have shelf presence. And so so I'm doing games all the time, and I kind of came up with a bunch of different games that were all these small games that I, you know, that were that are great fun, but they're not really marketable because they're too tiny to fit on to really fit on store shelf. So I said, you know, why not just put them all together and give, you know, people the collection, and then the box will be big enough that stores will want to put it on the shelf. So that was kind of the idea behind it all. And each game is for a different set of people, like a different size of group, a different genre, and kind of also a different age range or interest type. So there's a game for every occasion is kind of the slogan for the project.
All right. Have you taken any time out of developing to play anything else? I'm just curious.
Oh yeah, let me think. What am I playing? What am I looking forward to? I'm looking forward to Persona 4 Arena. That's what I'm
sure.
Looking forward to.
Okay, we can talk about video games if you like.
in terms of board games. You know, I'm kind of the guy who goes to game night and just plays whatever's on the table.
Yeah.
I play board games are a job for me. So I play to learn mechanics and I play to analyze. And I have fun doing it, but I don't have a specific favorite. I just want to play something I haven't played before.
Well, you know what? What game that you've played lately has particularly really bad mechanics?
Particularly really bad mechanics.
Yeah, what designers that has published work that you played recently isn't very good at what they do?
You know, I think the game that I was disappointed in the most was the Discworld Ankh-Morpork game.
Okay.
You didn't like Ankh-Morpork?
I didn't like Ankh-Morpork, the Martin Wallace one.
Wow.
And the big problem with the game is that it's a Martin Wallace game. And it really needs to be like a Cory Kinexia game instead. The guy that does the Fantasy Flight, like Mansions of Madness and those kind of games. Because it's a thematic game and Discworld players want this thematic experience, but the Martin Wallace games are, you know, dry strategic type experiences. And so it ends up having all this great art that really draws you in, and then you're like, oh, it's secret role, worker placement, you know, area control. Darn. So
okay.
But that's just a game where I feel like the designer, the mechanics were ill selected for the theme.
Oh, come on.
Perhaps.
Call
them
out.
Did you play Guards Guards?
I haven't played Guards Guards yet.
I wouldn't recommend it. Because I have. But I played that one first. That's maybe why I appreciate Ankh-Morpork a lot more.
Ah. I mean, well, it's good stuff and it works. I mean, like that Wallace type designs work really well for things like Few Acres of Snow. I just don't think it was a good fit for Discworld. That's all.
Okay. Fair enough.
Come on.
What you want? Like you want just some dump bile on a game as hard as I can?
Yes.
Worst game I ever played was Infighting, the D&D game.
Okay.
So you get a character, and your character has a power, and then you roll a die, and the die tells you what action you can do,
yeah,
and then you roll another die to see that action. And then, if you're lucky, you'll roll the die that lets you use your special power. And you kind of repeat
like
it on the table five times till everyone else is dead.
Okay.
It's not. It was basically designed to be a D&D night space filler for like when someone's out getting food or something, you pull this out and do that instead.
Okay.
Wizards of the Coast put out a lot of
D&D. Three Dragons was much better. Three Dragons better. So I guess
they put out a lot of things in that kind of niche D&D light spin up before they did things like the Castle Ravenloft and the Lords of Waterdeep. Mm.
This is one just in particular I felt was rather ill-conceived.
Okay.
But you can read my blog about it. I write a whole blog where I just trash it. So go check that out.
As long as you're hooking us in to any feuds you have with other designers and games, then we're good.
I don't even know who designed that game. You know.
Well, you should find them and punch them. All right.
You know, I'm sure it's not design, I'm sure it's marketing. You know, they push things out so quickly.
Yeah. No, but Chris Ingersoll, what have you been playing lately? What's got you excited about games?
What's got me excited about games right now is Android Netrunner being repurposed as a living card game by Fantasy Flight in a couple of months. I am going to be all over that like a monkey on a cupcake. But
so I can count on you getting that and introducing me to that, Chris?
Denise is the reason I'm getting some in. I'm the reason Denise is getting some in.
Very good.
But on the same list, my last gaming unplug call went for Android Infiltration, which is a quickie Donald Varencio, the guy that designed Dominion, does like as a cyber heist game, which is really fun.
That was a really fun one.
Quick playing. But mostly right now, the game that I am all about and have been ever since Chris Nord introduced me to it has been Sentinels of the Multiverse. This is a cooperative comic superhero game where there's 3 to 5 of you heroes taking on a villain, and there's all kinds of neat thematic cards and powers and stuff going on, and it's got new expansions coming out also next in August. That's going to be an expensive month for me. Well, that one I've already paid for because I went through the Kickstarter for that and their reissued base set, which became one of like the top 10 fastest or best produced board and card game Kickstarters. There's some guy in Board Game Geek has a geek list about that. I think it finished at number 6 of all time.
While you were over there getting the Sentinels and Multiverse expansion, did you get an Ottoman?
No, did not. Okay. I don't have any place I could put an Ottoman in my house.
My cat's
But yeah, really, I would have recommended Sentinels. Sentinels gets a lot of drive-by traffic too, because people come by and see like the comic book things, and we're getting all anguished. Like the villain flips over a card and it just wrecks us, and we all get mad. It's like, no, we're screwed. Or it's really well done art, all by the same guy. They have one guy over there, Adam Robardo, does all the art, and he is a machine. He puts up every card is illustrated by that man. He is put out. I don't think he has any stinkers. The one expansion base set and anything new that's coming out. But they've also in the new set coming out, the Richard Laurinus, I think the guy's name is, who did like the Arkham Horror design. He pitched in and has contributed a hero and a villain for the new set that's coming out, which is based around called Infernal Relics, based around the more spiritual, like heaven and hell type comp characters that we have in the game already. It hits every comic book trope you could think of, and if they haven't hit that yet, they're going to. Like one of the Kickstarter bonuses is Unity, who's a superhero who's a technomancer. Basically, she creates robots and crap with her mind, just without having any tools. On a gunbot, boom! I have a gunbot now. So that's something that we haven't had before that we will, if you pay the extra $5 for the Kickstarter when you win it.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the cool thing about Sentinels is that every deck, I mean, every hero has its own deck, and they all play different. I mean, you really kind of get that feel, and in some ways, it's even like you have to learn your powers and learn the way that they all work together, and then every environment. Yeah, exactly.
Isn't every environment, you kind of make this character your own through playing them a few times.
Yeah, and it's cooperative, so I love it. So it's great.
Yeah. So, Chris Norwood, is there anything else you've been loving lately? Anything you've been playing?
I bop around a lot. Last Will might be one of my current
hot ones. Yeah, I got to play that once, but can you tell us about that?
It's basically, the theme is Brewster's Millions, the board game, where your rich uncle gave you so much money and the first one to spend it all because he wasted his life making his money and had no fun. So whoever shows they can have fun the quickest gets all the rest of the fortune. So it's sort of an engine building game like a lot of kind of the Euro games are, but you're trying to lose money and you're trying to, you know, take your horse to the theater and stuff like that. It's just kind of...
It's like Maxwell's Millions or something that had kind of a similar plot to it.
I think Bruce
that movie's been remade a couple of times, yeah.
Right, Bruce exactly. Or
the most recent iteration of that, I think.
Exactly. But yeah, that's the basic idea.
I won our first game of that, actually, by throwing a bunch of parties.
Yes,
I went I went bankrupt in round 6 of 7. Everybody else was stuck with farms.
Last week, I think I went out in the fifth turn, but I got kind of lucky early on. But still, so that's an interesting one with an interesting theme, you know, something a little different. The Manhattan Project, that's another one that I like a whole lot. It's about basically the Manhattan Project. It's about, you know, researching and finding the atomic bomb. And it's a worker placement game, but they do things a lot different. There's a whole lot of kind of player interaction where you can you know, do espionage and use other people's buildings they're building, and you can also bomb them. You can, like, do airstrikes on them and take out some of their buildings and things like that. So it's kind of a whole different take on still a very strategic game with a nice theme. So that's one of my favorites this year for certain.
Well, cool. Yeah, people should definitely check that one out, because it definitely feels a lot different from you know, a lot of things we've been seeing lately in board games.
You can't nuclear bomb people. That was
no.
My other player was coming over and he was like using conventional bombs, espionage. I'm like, well, I'm gonna build a nuke and nuke this guy. But no, they just give me points.
Yeah, I think we call that World War III is the problem.
There's an alternate win condition where I win by nuking you.
That's a different game.
Everybody lose condition, I think, maybe would be that
Nuclear
one.
Nuclear War, I believe that game. Oh.
At that point, I believe the alternate win condition is flipping over the table or something. Like, yeah, who wins now, huh? Yeah, if you're that desperate. All right.
One other game I want to mention real quick that has gotten some play at our game group, and we'll probably see a lot more play next month because it stands a good chance of being our game of the month for July. It's going to be my column for this week is the Castles of Burgundy by Stefan Feld. And that is a game that is so revolving around a pair of dice every turn that you would think I would hate it unconditionally.
Yeah.
But the way he designed the game, the actual roll of the dice doesn't impact you as much as it would in another similarly designed game. He gets Stefan Feld put a lot of, like, you have worker tiles that you can cash in to adjust the die value up or down one, so you can kind of get where you need to go. And more importantly, he treats 1 and 6 as being adjacent, so you're never more than 3 tiles away from where you actually wanted to be.
Right.
But there's like 4 standard actions you can do for each die. So if you don't get the numbers you want, you may be able to do something else that's still going to get you where you want to go.
Right.
It makes the randomization very, very non-factor.
Manageable.
Right. Yeah.
Reminds me a lot of Alien Frontiers. They had a lot of like you could invest in tech and dice manipulate pretty well.
Right.
Right. There's that, and it's unlike similar games of that nature, like Kingsburg. If you roll higher values, you're not necessarily guaranteed to do better.
Right. I think that's what I like, is that there's no absolute best value on the die. It really depends on kind of what you need and where on your, you know, your board is empty or whatever it happens to be you're trying to use it for. So.
I think that wraps it up for us, but it's been great talking to you guys. Before we leave, Brad and Chris, do you want to plug a few things?
Okay. Graham mentioned it. I've been writing a board gaming blog for about 5 years. It's gamerchris.com. And actually, I recently started a podcast of my own. It's called Exploring Games. You can find it there at Gamer Chris, and it's also on iTunes now. So, you know, if you're interested in board games, give me a listen.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. Brad?
Oh, well, I'm Brad Totten, Level 99 Games, and LVL99Games.com. So come by, check out kind of what we're doing. We're working on this mini game library, so you can get 5 or more games that kind of suit every occasion. And we're also working on the next Battlecom game. So for fans of that, you know, come help with playtest, email me.
All right. Anyway. Got anything else in the pipe coming down after this project?
Oh, well, I was in Vegas last weekend talking with video game licensing companies, or video game companies who want licensed games. So, yeah, we talked to a few people.
Well, if anything comes of that, definitely let us know.
You'll be the first to know, Graham.
Okay. All right. All right, so we're going to talk about electronic games for a few minutes. And first we wanted to cover basically the main news of the last 2 weeks, which is Sean.
Santa Claus got my letter.
Santa Claus got Chris's letter. Sean, yes. You want to go in any detail about that?
Sure. Santa Claus went to Japan and made Iwata and all the other guys make a 3DS XL.
Okay.
However, he forgot to tell them about the second joystick.
Yes. And we can talk about that. But so basically the 3DS XL is, it has a 90% larger screen.
It's massive.
Which basically it's the same size as the DSi XL, but the top screen's widescreen because it's a 3DS. Basically. So they're doing that. They didn't add the second analog like people were thinking they were going to do.
I understand why, though. It would basically make the current 3DS models all but obsolete.
Yeah.
It's not something they really want to do.
Right, and honestly, the main point I've seen people make that I tend to agree with is that nothing that supports the Control Pad Pro thing that they have has in any way made it, you know, crucial that that's a thing. Like, I haven't played a game or seen a game that's, like, considerably better with it, so why, you know?
Yeah, there's only three or four games that really use it anyway.
Right.
In North America.
Yeah, and of those, maybe Resident Evil Revelations is the one where it's like, you know, this would be a good game with this, and maybe just an okay game without it. I've heard people that are just fine without it.
While not really relevant for the XL, I did see a third-party Circle Pad Pro that also contained a battery pack, which seems like it would be very useful.
Yeah, and I guess one thing we should mention about this, the 3DS XL is not going to fit that Circle Pad Pro.
No, they'll have to come out with Circle Pad Pro XL.
No, it's not. I'm just waiting for the bigger Circle Pad Pro.
But it may not need the battery pack, according to what Reggie said in Nintendo Direct. It said they had to improve battery life over the original model, which is another part of my letter to Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Now, he skipped over the part where I said games for the system.
But... yeah. Well, I mean, while we're not going to get into this, they did talk about some of the stuff we're getting later this year. They finally announced Professor Layton and Miracle Mask. We didn't get Professor Layton Ace Attorney
not yet.
I think that's more Capcom.
Yeah.
But
they better give it to us.
Yeah,
I'll be upset if they don't.
So at $199 with a 4 gig card,
red and blue.
Yeah.
Red.
Which makes my wife crazy because they just released the purple regular DSi, 3DS, and now she's torn between getting the red XL and the purple DSi, 3DS.
Yeah.
But battery life, I think, will be the deal breaker on that one.
I just think the white one they're getting in Japan is really cool looking, but I understand maybe it looks a little too much like the Wii U gamepad, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe like a random eye device.
Yeah. And then in Europe, they get one with silver accent instead of red or blue, which also looks pretty slick.
Can't get everything, but that's all I asked for was give me an XL and I will buy your system. So come August 19th, I have another $200 to throw at Best Buy.
Yeah, I might be trading in my system and upgrading to the XL myself.
Yeah, that is something, like, I'm not sure I'll do that, but... I've talked with a couple people about this is a great excuse to get a Japanese 3DS. Yeah. Okay. We'll see how that actually goes. But the problem with upgrading is that, you know, I have 3DS software. I have eShop stuff. I have my ambassador games.
All I have are my ambassador games.
Right now they don't let you transfer. Like, I kind of want to keep those.
Yeah, all I have is the ambassador games, so I guess I'll just beat the ones I care about before that happens, or hope that they offer a transfer thing.
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, so generally, like, I'm that was all right. I wasn't bothered by that announcement. I know some people were mad about it. But...
I'm bothered by why they didn't mention it a couple weeks ago. But other than that, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they had, it would have beat Andrew for second place.
They almost would have won E3 just by 3DS XL August 19th, $299.
Yeah,
$199.
Yeah, there's this small.
I got $200 and $199 confused in my head.
There's this small press event that happened a few weeks ago. They were at and didn't mention it, which was
right.
Kind of odd.
That's weird.
Yeah, I don't really understand, but that's okay.
Yeah, also not mentioning Professor Layton.
And also, like, announcing the event was going to happen like 13 hours before it happened.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I assume that they planned on keeping it under their hat a while longer, but the press in Japan got wind of it and was going to go public with it again.
Well, there were definitely reports. I know Nikkei was talking about, you know, hey, we've heard from manufacturers that there's this thing that you have. And yeah, and they're like, no, we're definitely not working on it.
By the way, we have a press conference scheduled tomorrow. Did you know that?
Yeah. So is and the, I love how they tacked on the Fire Emblem thing in there too, with just like, oh, here's one portion of the Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon logo. We're making the 3DS game. Okay. I thought after 2 weeks they'd have, like, I don't know, some, like, I mean, they already have the art from the Japanese game, so go ahead and have, like a mock-up box cover, or, like, here's the protagonist of the game, or something, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't...
Yeah.
They didn't put any effort into that at all.
No.
We also, I want to see what you guys think. We also heard that Capcom is going to be making the new Smash Brothers.
You mean Namco?
Namco, yes, my bad. Yeah. One of those companies that doesn't ever send anything over here, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Namco Bandai does a decent job.
Tails.
I know. You're sad about that.
I am very sad about it.
I'm mostly sure they're going to release the Smash Brothers in the United States.
I don't.
Can you imagine the outrage if they didn't?
I'm doing that now. That's why I'm laughing so hard.
Oh. Anyway, but I mean, it is weird that, like, they picked, I mean, so it's being led by Masahiro Sakurai, which makes sense. The guy who was the lead, who was like the producer on Tales of Vesperia, and the guy who is most well known for being the producer on Go Vacation. Hey. Which, maybe not that guy. But it seems like he's kind of in charge. Like, they mentioned the Tails guy because, like, hey, that's something people actually kind of like. But looks like Go Vacation guy's in charge. But you know what? I understand that they did it because they were dumb and talked about the fact that they were going to make one like 2 years before they could start working on it.
Because Sakurai was working on Kid Icarus.
Yeah, so, like, you know, it means we're going to get it, and in a timely manner, still feels to me like we may get it. I mean, maybe they rush it to get it out holiday 2013, but probably not.
Maybe. I would put money on not.
Yeah.
Right now.
To the speculator.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, we should cover that. Sean, write that down.
Okay.
That. But, yeah, the thing is, I do appreciate that they're Nintendo is doing a good job at trying to give third parties, like, kind of a piece of the pie. You know, that they're letting Namco be involved with this. They gave Square Enix the entire month of July. Sorry, that was just the one thing I noticed watching the Japanese and European press conferences talking about all the stuff they're releasing in July, and, like, they're releasing the 3DS XL in July, and then, you know, America's like, starting August 18th, we're going to start releasing things again. And then, you know, and then Square Enix is releasing one 3DS game a week for the month of July.
Yeah, are we getting any of them except for Theater Rhythm?
We're getting Theater Rhythm, we're getting Heroes Kingdom of Ruin, Hearts and Kingdom Hearts. Dream Drop.
I asked Kingdom Hearts.
Yeah.
The big title I really don't care about. I might, because I finally ordered Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2.
Oh, well, yep,
you
okay.
You got a month and a half to work on them. Go.
Yeah.
All right.
You have not even that long. Maybe a month.
Yeah, it's
I'm pretty sure it's like...
He's got like four more spin-off games before he gets to 3DS anyway.
Yeah, you had to get through 358 over 2 days. Yeah,
I have Burst by Sleep.
Chains of Memories.
Yeah.
Card-based thing.
And then Re-Chain of Memories. You got to do the same one over again. Yeah.
I don't think I would do the same one over again.
Okay. But no. And I'm really excited about Heroes of Ruin. It's a very Diablo-esque kind of thing with regular online for a 3DS game, which looks pretty great. Anyway, no one else cares about that. I'm the only one that talks about it ever. But still...
I'm getting it.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to play some. All right. But back to the whole Namco Smash thing. You know, Namco did develop Mario Kart for the arcades, and it's basically the worst thing.
Oh, you said Mario Kart. I was thinking F-Zero, which we didn't actually get. That was
F-Zero Sega. And
Sega.
Right.
Yeah.
Sega did both of those.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it, Namco did. There was another Star Fox.
Yeah, they did
the GameCube one.
Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, there was that whole Triforce thing with Namco and Sega and Nintendo back in the day. But this is interesting. I feel like they should hand over franchises like this. I'm not sure Smash is the best one. I'm almost guaranteeing you right now that Pac-Man's going to be playable in the new Smash Brothers.
Hey.
That and, like, for some reason, Heihachi or something, like someone we don't care about.
They have the Soul Calibur guys, aren't they?
Yeah.
No, Namco will continue to troll North America and include a bunch of Tails protagonists from games that didn't release here.
Oh, I will be so happy about that. I mean, you know, Nintendo did it themselves by putting Roy in Super Smash Bros. Melee.
And then Lucas.
And Brawl,
yeah.
Oh, Lucas.
Yep. But, you know, hey, you know, I'm okay with that kind of thing.
Although I think this does mean that Sonic and Snake are going to be retired from the roster.
Well, I do think Snake's going to be retired. Sonic, I feel like they'll probably still keep in there. But
no.
I'm getting the
sneaking suspicion that... The more worthless of the two?
I'm getting the sneaking suspicion that Snake is going to be in PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, at which point...
If I would actually expect Raiden before Snake, because Raiden has a game coming out soon.
Yeah, no, but
by popular
put them both in. Sony doesn't have anyone else.
Sony's got Kratos, and that's it.
Yeah. But
Fat Princess.
Because
they needed a girl. Fat Princess, because they needed a girl. That's...
Yeah,
right there.
That's totally, yeah. They were like, wait, we've never had a female protagonist. Oops.
No misogyny in video game at all. No, none.
Yeah. But I wouldn't be surprised to, for some reason, see, like, Ezio in this game or something. Because Ubisoft is apparently
Ezio
their best
anything.
Friend now. Yep. Actually, we're going to see Ezio in Animal Crossing for 3DS.
Oh, if I can cut our contract, Tom Nook's a Templar. That's all I have to say. <It's>...
No, but anyway, all right. But yeah, do you guys have any thoughts on that? Whether that's going to be like all right or?
I don't think they'll let them make it bad, really, because that is such a. It's not one of the main three. It's not the Zelda, Metroid, Mario thing, but it's all of them, frankly.
Yeah. And really, I mean, it's a much larger franchise than Metroid, really.
Right.
Yeah, I think the worst thing that could happen is that it becomes Brawl HD.
Yes.
It's basically unchanged from Brawl, except with higher resolution.
The worst thing that can happen is that they shoehorn in some asymmetric gameplay with the gamepad that has no business being in that kind of game.
Ooh, but like it... It could be, though.
Yeah.
I have ideas.
They were pretty smart with Brawl, and they supported like four different control schemes, so they'll probably do that again.
And it has to be playable. I mean, the base game has to be playable on the 3DS. So, it will at least have something resembling a normal game. Anyway. But, all right, hey, let's talk about some games we've been playing, all right? Yep. Hey, Sean.
Yo.
East Origin.
It was fun.
Okay. Talk about it. No.
I'm actually a newcomer to the East series. I haven't played any of them before. So
okay. Well,
I had no idea what I was...
So.
Yeah, I had no idea what to expect, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's got a very fast gameplay, but it's not too complicated.
Yeah.
The bosses are mostly pattern-based. You just have to learn the pattern before you can beat them, which caused me lots of deaths. But I didn't die other than that, so it wasn't too hard for me.
Yeah.
But for those that are better than me, which is almost everyone, there are 5 different difficulty levels, so you can make it as hard as you want to.
Yeah, Chris, sure, yep.
Yep.
For people who haven't played the series, and there are more of them than there should be, though one less than there was before...
yes.
What would you compare it to?
I haven't really played many other games like it, actually. I'm not big into the fast-paced action RPGs usually.
Yeah. Generally
I might get more into them now.
Yeah. Well, generally, I think that series has really been, I mean, more fast-paced, action-based, but it still, like, generally kind of like a top-down, mostly, like, sword and kind of basic attacks kind of action game.
Yeah. I've always...
It's kind of like a more action-y Zelda kind of thing.
Yeah, I've almost thought of it as a fast Zelda. Yeah. Without puzzles.
That could work.
Yep.
I haven't played many Zeldas either, sadly. So, last time I played was Ocarina of Time. Other than...
You played Link's Awakening?
I have not.
Okay.
Remember, I put that on the bottom of my list for a reason.
We're gonna pause the recording, and you can play Link's Awakening, and we'll be right back.
Sean is going to go get his 3DS and download it, and then we'll be back in 5 minutes.
Yep.
I don't think play it in 5 minutes.
No, seriously, like, sometime soon, play that game. Let us know what you do, and we're going to talk about it.
Okay.
But yeah, so East Origin, worth checking out?
Definitely.
Okay.
Also, it has great, great music.
Yeah, games like that tend to have just like really cool scores.
Yes.
Anyway.
It definitely had great music.
I have been playing a little puzzle game called Splice. It is from developer Cypher Prime. I don't know if you guys are familiar with their work. They're most famous for doing Auditorium, which is this like very like music-based orchestral thing. Have either of you played that game?
No.
It
sounds vaguely familiar, but no, I haven't actually played it.
Yeah, Chris, I know. I mean, it hasn't been on any Nintendo platforms, but
they're mostly
PC, and they're doing a lot of iOS stuff now. But Auditorium was on PSN, I believe, for both the PSP and the PS3.
Maybe that's where I heard about it. They do really a random review,
right? We definitely reviewed those, but they do very atmospheric games. And this game is about, like, it's nominally about gene manipulation, but basically it's, I don't know if you've played, like, Space Chem, but it's very similar, like, these things do these things, and you have to trigger them in the right order kind of game. And that's really cool. The music's a little, I don't know. I have really high standards for Cypher Prime stuff, but it's a lot more... A lot more atmospheric and a lot less melodic this time, but it's a cool little game. I think you guys should check it out. Anyway, but yeah, let's talk about the one more game before we head out of here, and it's the big one, I think, Pokemon Conquest.
So much fun.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a weird adaptation of the Pokemon franchise, where, like, I'm still not sure how evolution works in this game, but it happens.
Yeah.
And your warlords can evolve too, which is like if your trainer could evolve in the game,
right?
In the main series game, which is something else I'm not quite delving into spoiler sites to figure out yet.
Yeah, well, from what I know, I've been playing it a little bit too. From what I know, how it works is the more you fight with your Pokemon, the higher your link percentage becomes.
Right, and they level up their attack and stuff.
Yeah, that's basically your level. So when they reach a certain link percentage, they evolve. And I believe you do too, but I think like the protagonist in the main storyline...
Right, the protagonist, his evolution is set. Yeah. I know that.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this in a forum post about the game, is what this game has done, I think more than anything else, is... It really captures the anime style of gym battles, where you have the specific terrain and there's weird things happening that's like steel specific or water specific.
Yeah, and that part's really fun.
That is awesome. Those castle battles are intense. The steel one in particular, that stymied me for a while, because you get like cranes that'll randomly put you in a different part of the board, and it's got gates you can open and close by stopping on it with a Pokemon that doesn't fly or levitate, and that's annoying too on another end.
Yeah.
It's like there's all kinds of board interactions that if you got a fly or a levitator, they don't do, because it involves sitting on the trigger.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that part was great to me, because like they tried to do that in their mainstream Pokemon games by doing like those puzzles and things like that.
Right, in the gyms themselves, but the battles were just the same all the time,
right?
Just animating back and forth until one of you drops.
And I think those puzzles in the gyms in the main game just generally weren't that compelling, because it was like, why? I just get punished by getting pushed in front of a trainer or something like that.
Right.
Like this part is all integrated, and you know, having
there was one, I think, in Diamond and Pearl, where it was the ghost gym where you basically answered math problems. if you got them wrong, you had to face a trainer. I would get them wrong intentionally to face the trainers to get more experience.
Right.
So why even put them there?
Yeah.
The biggest thing with Conquest is it brings it past just being type matching.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's crucial,
too.
It is.
Well, especially since you only get one move per Pokemon now.
Right.
If you got a ground type that's known a ground type attack and you're up against a bunch of flyers, well, you need a different guy.
Right. Like there's one of the main powerhouse characters in the main storyline that is a psychic fighting type.
Right.
And, hey, he's a fighting type, right? I should use him against stuff that's weak against fighting. He doesn't have a fighting move.
No, he's just got Psycho Cut. That's all he's got.
Yeah.
If you're up against like a dark
right, say steel type, like say a dark steel type, yeah.
You'd punch the crap out of him because he's double weak to that, but all you have is a psychic type that he's immune to.
Yep.
What the hell?
Weird how that battle happens right after you get that guy.
Right.
But yeah, so there's a lot of that strategy there, and I think like the way they simplify that game where you only have one move makes it more interesting. I think it's better that way that you have a move, an activated ability, and a passive ability. And I think that like that's enough depth when you're using all six at once and moving them around. And
I think, though, having played like tactics games of similar natures, they could have added two moves. But then that's a whole lot more crap to keep track of. I think you could have, just in case you run into this kind of contingency, but then they maybe wouldn't have as much of an excuse for you to link with the wild Pokemon.
Right. They did do some interesting things, I think, with the evolution. Like, yes, when you reach a certain link percentage, you evolve, but you can stop it, like in the base games. And, in the main series, it was all about maybe you can learn moves faster, basically.
Right, but there's no reason to stop now, other than some links go down. Right, yeah.
But when you evolve, the move changes. And while the move usually gets more powerful, I know, like, one of my main people had, like, a range attack that hit all of the spots around, and then evolved and got stronger, but only hit one spot two spaces away. And like, wow.
Was that the electric leader?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so she starts with a Luxio, or whatever, the unevolver, and that's just a charge tackle. So it hits the guy right in front of him. When it evolves into whatever the next step is, it's going to discharge. It hits everything around him. And then Luxray, the final evolution, is Thunder, which is, like you said, one spot three away.
And
yeah,
that is and something doesn't hit very often.
Right, because it's friggin' Thunder, and that's not a move I would keep on my Pokemon for any normal reason in the mainline games, because I'd have like Thunder Shock.
But it's interesting because it's a very strong electric type, so you just kind of got to deal with it, which I like a lot. I like the limiting of what you can do. You know, I like that. Like, okay, I got to figure out how to make these puzzle pieces work, rather than the main series where it's just like, I guess I'll go grind, and I guess I'll go get these other things. I'm like,
right. I will say that flyers in this game seem to be a little bit overpowered, where they can just dodge obstacles on the board a lot.
Yeah.
But I think they make up for that by making them not as strong. I haven't run into any flying type that I've been, I have to kill that thing now, other than when I have like fighting types and bug types and grass types, but that's just type matching.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was like, I have taken advantage of that, although there is one flying type that's a little overpowered. Do you have a Gyarados yet?
I don't have one yet, but I know.
If you can evolve a Magikarp into a Gyarados in this game, you are set for a good long time.
That's tough to do because it has one move and it splash.
Right. So you have to lug them around uselessly.
Yeah.
But yeah, Gyarados
to pick up stuff.
Right. Gyarados has one move and it's Aqua Tail and it doesn't mess around.
No, it doesn't. But yeah. So, I mean, I love the crap out of this game.
Yeah, it is fun.
I will say there's a little bit of micromanagement that's kind of obnoxious of like having to move your people around all the time.
Pain. And the other thing I didn't like was to switch if you link with another Pokemon to switch, you have to go into the info menu, which seemed when I'm selecting the guy I want to send in the battle, let me do it then.
Yeah.
The guy and then pick the Pokemon he wants to take in with him.
Yeah.
Instead of having eight other steps to get there. And like I mentioned this on my new Twitter account, thanks to our community manager.
Yeah. Brad.
It's been driving me up the wall that the X button doesn't open menus in this game.
Yeah, okay. But also, the X button trigger like gets you into your warrior abilities once you've selected a Pokemon to move. But if you haven't selected them, it's the in-turn button.
Thank God it asks for confirmation every time.
I know, because Like, when you accidentally back out and you're just, like, idling over a Pokemon, it almost looks like they're selected. Like, it's just a slightly different color blue of the movement area. So it's like, I think I do that about 5 times a battle.
At least.
Yeah.
I've never accidentally canceled a turn, but I've come awfully close.
Yeah. And that's one thing where I guess you could use the touchscreen.
I've tried using the touchscreen. And the problem with that is moving the camera around is such a nuisance.
Yeah, it's because it's not a straight down grid like, say, Advanced Wars or something. It's isometric.
Like even on the world map, you basically have to tap in random places to get them to go where you want to go.
Yeah. Yeah, but the game's really good. So
it is. I have the main storyline where you're uniting the 17 regions, which happens to exactly correspond with the title.
Yeah,
I didn't realize until I was about halfway through. Like, oh, 17. That's a convenient number.
Yeah.
And then you get the legendary Pokemon and go all god mode for one fight. Yeah. That was a little anticlimactic. But the main problem I had was that they give you all these options, like delegating your guys, like improve this area and do that and do that. And it doesn't really do anything in the main storyline. Like, you can't actually improve anything by developing your stuff in the initial 20 or so hours that you have before you get all the side post-game side quest stuff.
Right.
So it seemed like that could have been more, but I understand why they didn't. Just train them up and go fight. Then we'll give you all these other things.
Yeah. But I do like that it kind of made these self-contained things, because one thing I've always been frustrated by in like the main series Pokemon post-game is that you're basically just too overpowered. Like, there are a couple special things you can do later, but really it's like, I guess I could develop a team of people who won't necessarily kill these guys so I can catch them. it's coming up with your own things to, to make it challenging. But like,
and then breeding and all that, good custom building your team and whatever.
Yeah, and there's a lot to that, but it's not necessarily like an interesting like game at that point, more than it
becomes a grind fest at that point.
It's farming, is what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah. Jeff, you've been playing some Conquest. Do you have any thoughts about it?
Well, I think Pokemon is a series that's needed something fresh and new for a long time, and Conquest kind of fills that.
Yeah.
It certainly fills it better than the other spin-offs they've had recently. Dungeon and Ranger nonsense.
Yeah. Mystery Dungeon was all right.
If you like roguelikes like that.
Right, and it's the most accessible that.
Yes.
And I know a lot of people who've gotten into that because of it.
Rumble was an interesting departure that I enjoyed a little bit. Yeah. I got the WiiWare version of Rumble.
Yeah. It's fun when you don't expect too much.
Yes.
Yeah. But I just hope that this becomes a series, which if Nintendo lets them, Tecmo-Koei is absolutely going to make more Pokemon Conquest games.
They are, yeah. There seems to be some difficulty finding this game, and I'm not sure whose fault that is. If it's on the retailer's end, if it's on Nintendo's end.
It's Nintendo's end, because they've done this before. Same thing happened with Rhythm Heaven Fever. Same thing happened with, every... They've been doing this weird Monday release thing where they say it's released on Monday, but nobody has it on Monday. Some people have it on Tuesday. No, some people don't have it until next week.
There's that, especially with us on the East Coast, where we have a whole day's shipment from we get from one side to the other. But that's not quite – I'm talking about actual – by now it's been out for a week in theory.
Yeah.
And it's still hard to find.
Yeah. Well, I know – like
undershipped.
I believe Best Buy officially changed the release date to the 25th.
No, because I got mine at Best Buy.
Okay.
Well, they got them in, but you may have to.
Yeah.
We've had to wrangle somebody to go into the back to find them.
Yeah. I know there was some confusion there. But.
Yeah.
I got mine at GameStop, and they only got just enough to fill pre-orders on Monday.
Yeah, I think Best Buy got like 3.
They need to have that game in stores
because that is the
Pokemon, problem. And they like money.
People want this game, but it's not available.
Yeah. I thought it was weird that this was the time they released it anyway, because I know this is kind of their dumping ground for things that are small market. Like, this is when last year they released Dragon Quest Monsters Joker 2, which, sure, that's fine. Like, release this many copies of that. But this is a Pokemon game.
Even if it's a spin-off Pokemon game, it's still a Pokemon game. And,
and it's much more like a Pokemon game than, like, Pokemon Troze.
Right.
Dash or, you know, something like that. Like,
or even the Ranger ones.
Game. Yeah, and those Ranger ones I think actually had some success. But yeah, so like, have this in stores, guys.
I remember when this game was announced, it was just, everyone was just Pokemon and Nobunaga's Ambition. Oh, that'll never be in North America.
And it apparently isn't.
Right. All right. But yeah, I think generally get that game.
Yeah, especially, and it's on the DS and not the 3DS, so there's no excuse to not have it because everybody should own a DS by now.
Yeah.
In some form or another.
Absolutely.
Possibly more than one.
Correct.
All right. That about wraps up this episode. But
or sub-episode.
But yeah, for the whole crew, Chris, Jeff, Sean, Chris, Chris, Jeff, Sean, Chris,
and Brad. Chris.
Yeah. I'm Graham. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Snack Bar Games Podcast. Follow us on the web at snackbar-games.com or on Twitter at snackbargames.